You are listening to a free version of Majority Report with Sam Steeter. To support the show and get another 15 minutes of daily program, go to majority.fm, please.
The Majority Report with Sam Steeter, where every day is casual Friday. That means Monday is casual Monday. Tuesday, casual Tuesday. Wednesday, casual hump day. Thursday, casual Thurs. That's what we call it. And Friday, casual Shabbat. The Majority Report with Sam Steeter.
It is Friday, August 14th, 2015. My name is Sam Steeter. This is the four-time award-winning Majority Report. We are broadcasting live steps from the industrially ravaged Gowanus Canal in the heartland of America, downtown Brooklyn, USA. It's Casual Friday, folks. What a crazy week. On the program today, Cliff Schechter will be joining us. And then, to cap off the week, to give me and you, and probably more you than me at this point, a suggestion as to a streaming video or film to watch over the weekend. Film Guy Matthew will be in studio. Also on the program today, disqualified. It doesn't look like this whole Chuck Schumer warmongering thing is blowing over as easily as he thought it would. Is his potential Senate leadership of the Democrats in peril? One can only hope. Also, Joe Biden, Al Gore, are they jumping into the race?
I don't know.
Could be, could not.
Maybe.
The earth, the environment, the internet.
Al Franken, that Jewish, gayish, apparently, senator, came out in favor of the Iran agreement. That's a reference to a strange... Was that a headline on Haaretz?
Tweet.
I don't know.
Al
weird.
Franken's gay and Al Gore's running for president.
The EPA, in the process of cleaning up a leaching mine, causes a massive hard metal spill into a river in Colorado. And somehow people equate that with being the same thing as if they were seeking profits and dumping their crap into a river or the ocean or the ground. We'll talk about that. Target stores do the most innocuous thing and get the most hilarious response when it comes to gendered products in their stores. We will talk about all that and more. Oh, incidentally, Bernie Sanders had requested a report from the CBO on the implications of the sequester. It's cost us more than a million jobs. And we're not going to get too far into this, but I remember at the time, and I'm not going to name names. It doesn't matter. But I just remember at the time. And, you know, I pay attention, and maybe less so these days, but certainly then, to what other liberal talkers are saying. And usually it's just because I like to get agitated. I mean, maybe that's what it is. But there were multiple ones who were saying President Obama's a genius for proposing this sequester. And he did propose it. He thought he was outfoxing the Republicans, because the sequester contained cuts to the military as well as social programs, as to the the discretionary budget. And the idea was this, that the Republicans will never cut military spending. And therefore, we won't see the other cuts. And therefore, President Obama will win this sort of fiscal cliff battle. And it was a fundamental miscalculation, both in terms of the nature of the Republican Party, the nature of the establishment in this country, and the history when we have seen things like this. The analogy I would make is this, is that the whole idea of cutting taxes, what we'll do is we'll cut taxes and we'll close loopholes so that by cutting taxes, it's still revenue neutral. And then what we've seen every time you've seen that, whether it was when the Kennedy administration did it, cutting the top tax rates from 90-some-odd% to 75%, when Reagan did it in the mid-80s, cutting the top tax rates, supposedly closing loopholes. Well, what happens is a year or two later, the loopholes are reopened. Bit by bit, bit by bit. And in this instance, in terms of the sequester, certainly the Republican Party was inclined to believe that would happen. And frankly, I'd be surprised if it doesn't in the future, where we start to see military expenditures going back up to pre-sequester levels at a time when, of course, we don't have nearly the military threats that would justify the size of the military we have as it is now. And that's their assumption, and it's probably a good one. The idea is if we can cut social programs, it's much harder for politicians to get the political will to expand those programs or to refund them to their prior levels. That's just the way these trends go. So it was a stupid deal. And now we're living with the consequences. Million point two or three less jobs than we would have had. All right, we're going to take a quick break. We'll be right back with Cliff Schechter. Just a reminder, folks, your membership makes this show possible. Become a member today at majority.fm. JustCoffee.coop, fair trade, coffee, tea, or chocolate. Use the coupon code MAJORITY. Get 10% off your coffee. They have free shipping now. We'll be right back. Cliff Schechter. Yes, ladies and gentlemen, we are back on the Majority Report. It is Friday, ladies and gentlemen, casual Friday. And to celebrate, we like to play this little song.
Cliff Schachter, Libertas LLC. New media, public relations, and strategy. You want any of these services, you know who you gotta see. Cliff Schachter, Libertas LLC.
Oh, yes, Cliff Schachter. The last time we spoke, buddy, was really actually quite late in the evening, maybe around midnight, last Thursday, a week ago yesterday, following the debate. Maybe we should just, recap a little bit, see where our predictions went. Have you recovered from that evening, Cliff? Sorry. Say that again. Cliff, have you recovered?
Can you hear me?
I can now, yes.
Okay. No, you know how old I am. I'm like your age. At our point...
No, you're not as old as me, buddy. Not even close.
Well, I'm close. And at our point, at our age, just a late night out can cause like a three-day hangover.
That's true.
So, I mean, I have recovered. I'm feeling pretty good about some of our predictions there. I think the one who I was the strongest was going to suffer was Scott Walker. I like to toot my horn on that one.
Mm-hmm.
He took it on the chin, so to speak. We both didn't think Jeb did great. You thought he performed worse due to expectations. He seems to have faltered too. So you were very right on that. I guess I can get a somewhat right.
Uh-huh.
I think we both thought Ted Cruz, and I still think it's that one statement that he made on that, what he was going to do his first day in the White House, where basically, it was going to be like fire and brimstone and dogs and cats living together and shit like that.
Yep.
And he seems to have gone way up. I thought he would go up, but more than I thought. We both thought Carson would go up.
I was surprised by how well Carson did. I mean, I didn't think he did poorly in there. I just didn't think that he did much, but he certainly went up more than I had anticipated.
Me too. I thought he had the most split evening of all of them, in that the first half I thought he was barely coherent. I mean, he said a couple of things that I couldn't even make out what he was talking about. Whereas the second half, maybe he was nervous. He hadn't done something like this before. I don't know. Yeah. But the second half, to me, was completely different, and that's frankly what people remember, so you'd rather do it that way. And that's where he kind of became funny and relaxed and made stronger statements. And went to his whole shtick.
Implied that Obama was a Manchurian candidate.
Right. And he went to the whole shtick of, I'm an African-American, but conservative, and there's other African-Americans who, like Obama, that are hurting black people kind of thing. He loves, the audience loves that.
Mm-hmm.
You're right. I don't know that I saw him going up that much, but I did think he would rise. And I didn't think Carly Fiorina, I mean, it's all due to press attention because not nearly as many people were watching that one that she was in, would go up as much too, And I'll say another person who seems to either have stayed the same or gone down a little bit, which I wasn't sure which way it would go, is Huckabee.
Right.
Kasich shot up in New Hampshire.
Yes, which I was not surprised about, frankly.
I wasn't, and it's also important to note that Kasich, I think, when we do the tactics of a campaign, I don't know if everybody here, is the political junkie I am, in that I care a lot about policy, but I've also worked a lot on campaigns and, study them and work on them and do whatever. And, he did something that I think is incredibly smart. You have these people who raise a bunch of money and they hoard it all for the end, and then there's no point in the end because you're already out of it, which is a strategy I've always thought is stupid. You can refer to it, if you want, as the John Kerry strategy.
Mm.
Of running for office. Whereas to me, he raised some money. There's no guarantees he'd raise any more. He was a blip in the polls. So he said, I'm going to make some noise and I'm going to do well enough that then when I'm higher in the polls and getting more press attention, I'll be able to raise more money. And so he didn't just go into that debate and do well, but he was on the air in New Hampshire in a pretty serious way. He went up and had ads up for at least, I think, a week, 2 weeks on, network, on cable, whatever. And I think that helped too, because his name recognition went up. So, to me, I'll give him kudos and a smart strategy. So it becomes really interesting in New Hampshire at this point, because Kasich and Jeb are kind of within the margin of error of each other. Trump's still up, seven or six, 7 points on them or whatever it is. And whoever comes out of there you know, even if it were to end up that way, whoever were to come out second would end up probably being, you know, it's not to say that they would, the other one would disappear. I mean, obviously, Jeb's got $100 million in a super PAC. He's sticking around. But they'll become the one that will start getting more attention as a sort of normal alternative to the crazy person who wins, be that, you know, if it's Trump who hangs on, or if I could see easily if Trump were to falter and fall, you know, Trump seems to like Ted Cruz a lot. They don't criticize each other. I could see him endorsing Cruz.
Well,
and a lot of that support going to Cruz.
I'll tell you something. I'm quite convinced. I mean, and Trump seems to be really determined to win Iowa, not so determined to win, you know, down the road. He's not spending.
The presidency.
What's that? Yeah, he's not spending the money in the other states that one might anticipate. I'm not convinced. I mean, you know, at this point, we have to start wondering, like, what is Trump thinking? Like, does he really want to be president? I think he just wants to win and not serve, which is obviously difficult to do. But it would not surprise me if in his mind, the goal is to get to be the guy who picks the nominee.
That's right.
And so
that, I mean, basically you can't try to figure out Trump like you'd figure out a normal human being. As long as he's being constantly covered and coveted, then he's happy.
Right.
He needs the media to cover him, and he needs people to be kissing his ass. And as you're saying, which I agree 100% with, if he's in that position, then he's getting that. You know, so I think he'd be perfectly happy with that, because I don't know that he really, in the end, wants to be president still. As much as he's gone much further this time than any of those misfires in the past, still, when it comes right down to it, he's, you know, for him to be president, he'd have to give up a lot of the idiocy that is his life. I mean, even if he acted like the biggest jackass in the White House in the history of the White House, you know, he still would have to give up many things that he does. You know, I mean, they do have rules about Secret Service and stuff.
Right.
So, you know, I think you're totally right about that. I could see him trying to sort of be the kingmaker in the end. And that's, you know, that's dangerous for the Republican Party, because he has.
Oh, you think,
you
know, so?
A bit. Well, it is, because, I mean, look, it wouldn't be if you know, I mean, I could pick 50 other people who would love to be kingmaker. And,
well,
you know,
but and you know, and you know,
will endorse somebody, and nobody will give a shit,
right?
It's a tree falling in the forest.
But, and it's not like Trump's going to be show some humility about it. I mean,
no,
he's going to say, like, look, I want the primetime spot on the convention. And
that's,
I'm going to tell everybody, I decided, I wanted, I said, after all, you know, Jeb's not such a bad guy. I'm going to let him be the winner.
Hey,
and that's
it. Got great ratings. The ratings
are
great. You know, yeah, but what's dangerous about it is, I think, because if Cruz were still at 2, 3%, then, you know, Trump's endorsement may be, because obviously not everybody who Trump is getting support from is going to go to whoever he, you know, he endorses.
Right.
The danger is clearly that Cruz is aiming for South Carolina. He just wants to get through to South Carolina, and that's where he's going to make his – that will be his Alamo, so
mm-hmm.
to speak.
Mm-hmm.
And I certainly think that it's possible that if in the end he can make it to that point and Trump doesn't, Trump's endorsement could be what puts him over the line. And then you've got a number of southern primaries, right? Florida, others. I mean, you'd think Florida would benefit Rubio and Bush, but it depends where they are by then. And the people that turn out are obviously as conservative as hell. And you'll get to the big Super Tuesday, right? I think they're still doing it that way,
yep,
of all the southern states. So Ted Cruz is a player now. I mean, he's no longer just a blip, because Trump has the power to take Cruz's numbers that have already reached the point where he's only a couple points behind Jeb, you know, in national polls and whatever. And in Iowa, certainly, he's maybe ahead. I haven't seen the recent Iowa poll, but he's up there in third or fourth. He gets Trump's support, too, and boom. So,
yeah, and,
you know, we could get our dream. Ted Cruz could be the most unlikable person since Barry Goldwater, but on top of that, really, somebody four times as crazy and five times as much outside of the mainstream could end up being their nominee, which is just such a dream.
And we should say, too, that, you know, from a policy perspective, I mean, the value of keeping particularly those two guys in my estimation, right, is something like the TPP, which we talked about the other day on this program, that a writer in The Economist, at least, thinks that the TPP is dead for now just because of a tough negotiation they had, I guess now almost 2 weeks ago in Hawaii, that it's just not going to happen, at least at this time. But even if they were to come to a deal now in, let's say, a month or two, then you start getting into these other debates. And if it comes up in front of the Senate while Trump is still in the race, Trump's going to come out and he's going to get a question about the TPP. And then that's going to force Ted Cruz's hand, who's going to find some new reason to not like it because Trump doesn't like it. And then this is going to get caught up in the politics. He's just going to be, yes, he's exactly, he's going to be, this is a bad deal. It's an awful deal. I would get a much better deal, and I wouldn't give President Obama the opportunity to make a deal. I would wait until I'm there to make the deal. I wrote the book, on the deal. You know, that's the, the art of the deal, whatever it is. So, you know, this is why, you know, this stuff really has a resonance and an importance in a way, frankly, that years past haven't, because we have so many people in the Senate who are trying to run.
Yep.
And a guy who's sitting on stage who is their titular leader on some respects, right? I mean, Ted Cruz, he doesn't want to create much distance between him and Donald Trump, particularly on a deal. I mean, who knows more about a deal than Donald Trump?
I just
made Michael spit his coffee up on his computer. I'm not going to pay for that.
Oh, did you bust his computer?
I'm not going to
pay for that.
All right, so let's talk about a deal. Let's move on to something else that is another deal. And where, according to Donald Trump, Obama got rolled by the Iranians. I mean, if Donald Trump was to make that deal, you know that pistachios would be free in this country.
The Ayatollah would be appearing on the next season of The Apprentice.
That's right.
Yeah,
it's pistachios would be completely free. So during that debate on Thursday night, there was another piece of news that dropped, and it's impossible to say that this was not
dropped. It was purposely placed out there at the optimum moment for someone to weasel their way past getting slammed by 1,000 different news organizations all at the same time.
Janine and I used to call this, the Friday evening news dump. We used to call that the one cheek sneak. Where you don't want it to make much noise, but you hope that the smell dissipates over the weekend. And that's what Chuck Schumer was hoping when he announced that he was going to vote against the deal, the Iran deal. And
sadly, I've noticed no dissipation.
Well, that's the thing that I've been really impressed by, is that in the first the first thing you saw was you had liberal groups like Move On, Peep Triple C, Credo, I think delivered a warmonger petition of literally over
all of them together, seriously, in a couple of days, to be accurate. I think all of them together got over 700,000 signatures.
700,000 signatures. Wow.
And I mean, that's the difference between when people ask me, because I was having a conversation with somebody the other day about Al Gore. You've probably seen that it's been thrown around. He is getting into the race again, which I completely don't think will happen.
No, never.
But just out of interest, what would be different? He was saying, well, remember he was stiff back then, and he was scared. And my thoughts were two, which one was that, he was a different person because he had been in the shadow of politics under his dad and himself his entire life and didn't know the outside world, frankly. But two was that we did not have the existence of anything to fight back with. That period of time when he ran 2000 was maybe the worst period of time. There were no blogs. There was no cable channel or alternative cable channels that had a progressive point of view in the slightest on them. There was nothing. I mean, social media obviously didn't exist. And already Fox News started in 96. It was gaining ratings. Rush had been around for a while, and all the local little Rushes. And
Move On was still not quite, it was different. I mean, Move On, people are going to forget
started
this.
Started in 98 or something over impeachment, but it
yes.
hadn't yet gotten to that,
right.
that point. And obviously, the other ones didn't exist. So we had nothing to answer when they would just make crap up. And then the New York Times would cover it because it felt like, well, the National Review is saying it and the Weekly Standard, we have to. And that's what's changed, because here Chuck Schumer thinks he can sneak through, thinks he can, just do this. And as you said, you and Janine, I'll give you guys your credit for the one cheek sneak. Nothing going on there. I mean, what happened was these groups went out immediately. I mean,
yes.
on the listservs I'm on, they were on it that night while the
yep.
debate was going on. And that became a story in and of itself, that all these groups got all these signatures. So that started, and then coverage continued. And he's gotten away with nothing. And then it's also continued, obviously, because he hasn't gotten one other Democrat. There's a few on the fence, but not one other has joined him. Obviously, there's lobbying going on from the White House, but I'm sure from other members of Congress, too. They're not one House member that I'm aware of has joined, which is amazing, because there still are a good half dozen blue dogs of, like, not just blue dogs, but of the very blue dog variety in the House. You know, your Colin Petersons and people that I thought we would lose somebody in, and we haven't. And then you've got this guy whose name I can't remember, who's the head of this this organization that was against the Iran deal.
Oh, yeah. This is a great story, actually.
It really is.
I was mad at Jim Webb. Because he forced me to say the name Joe Lieberman when Joe Lieberman came out in
support. You thought those two words would never again pass.
I honestly.
Together, didn't you?
Yes.
If you could say somebody Lieberman or Joe somebody, but you just didn't think you'd ever have to say those two together again.
No, I was hoping that was sort of my big wish I was banking on for the rest of my life was that I want to live out my life and never have to say that man's name again. However, he came out in support of Jim Webb from a no labels perspective, which is a whole nother
really,
story.
They've endorsed Jim Webb?
Well, I don't know that they've endorsed him, but they've basically insinuated that he would be a perfect no labels type of candidate.
That's awesome. I mean, that would get him up to 1.25%.
Exactly. And so there's this organization, United Against Nuclear Iran, UANI. And it is a an influential.
It flows right off the tongue.
Oh, it does.
Gwani.
Yes, and it's an influential bipartisan group that opposes the Iran nuclear deal, and I mean bipartisan. So people understand, Democrats, Republicans can come together sometimes in their lust for war. We've seen it many times, and this is one of those organizations where they do. Well, the head...
It's sort of a PNAC is what you're saying.
In a way. Yeah, in a
yeah,
way.
I mean, they always have these 3-4-letter goofball organizations like this, and they're just a retread of the same old thing, which is...
Neocons.
...find a way to fight 6 wars. And yeah, neocons, but specifically neocons who want to find a way to do what Pearl... Well, you know, what was his first name? Not Daniel Pearl. That's a terrible mistake. I can't think of his first name, but in his book,
Richard Pearl, you're talking about
Richard, right? The 8 different countries we should go in and invade and take over, right?
Right.
I mean, his list: Iraq is what we started with, you know, and Afghanistan, and there was Iran, and there was Syria, and there was Lebanon, and there was Somalia. Maybe Egypt is on there. I think Texas. I don't remember who else.
So the head of this organization, United Against Nuclear Iran, had been very skeptical of the Iran deal as it was being negotiated, as the parameters were being put out. Apparently, at one point, he responded to the Supreme Leader Ali Khamenei's red lines about what would be allowed in terms of examining their facilities. But when the deal came out, this guy, Gary Samore, supported it. He said he was surprised at what was negotiated. He was pleasantly surprised. He thinks that this deal fulfills the requirements of an organization called United Against Nuclear Iran. Well, what happened was they basically said, it's not going to work out between us. Now that
we
you like the deal.
We need to send out emails and raise more money. How do you think we're going to go rent that beach house in Martha's Vineyard this summer?
Exactly. And so he stepped down, and lo and behold.
In? It's like a light shone down from heaven.
Yes. Holy Joe Lieberman stepped in with that bloodlust just dripping through his veins. And
his fingertips, and he was like the guy, the American Werewolf in London once he transforms into the wolf.
And the thing is,
Joe Lieberman.
Joe, I mean, you can see where the opponents of the Iran deal have to move, right? Sam Orr is an actual expert at arms control, and he's a policy-oriented guy.
Right.
Then they trade him out. Right. They trade him out for a guy who is just basically a lobbyist for war. And to be fair, for, morality and piousness. And he's with us on everything but the war, as they say about pharmaceuticals.
He's with us everything on the war. Oh, wait, but affirmative action. Well, everything but the war and affirmative action.
Right.
Oh, wait, he had a problem with birth control. Oh, wait, but everything with the war, birth control. I mean, seriously, it was such a joke.
And like Medicare for all. I mean, and Medicare, and buy-ins at age 55.
Right. We go on. There's about eight other things he had a problem with at one point or another. He was for charter schools. He was whatever. The point being, they bought themselves a hack. I mean, they had to buy him. Joe, I'm sure Joe was available easily to do this. But the key point is, and I don't know why those on the side of the deal don't have this up on like every TV right now. The guy who was the head of the organization opposed to this changed his mind and decided he was for it, so he left his organization. If there's any better metaphor, I don't know what it is. And the truth is that if the Republicans weren't the crazy group of people that they are now, you'd find, I promise you that except for the fact that this is a vote they have to take so they can be, pretend to play moderate on some other issues – people like Susan Collins and Mark Kirk and a few of them would never actually really be against this.
Right.
It's a sensible deal. And if you still had some of those foreign policy realists, or your Dick Lugers and George Voinoviches and people like Bob Doles and people like that, they'd be for the damn thing too. It's just who we're dealing with here is what has changed. I promise you behind closed doors, James Baker and Brent Scowcroft and those guys are for it.
Now, what's interesting, getting back to Schumer for a minute, because people have to understand that when a vote is taken on this, people anticipate it's going to the agreement is going to be struck down, or at least the president's ability to fulfill the agreement. He has the statutory authority to loosen the sanctions. They're going to try and take that statutory authority away. That bill will pass. And then the president will veto it and send it back to one of the two houses, one of the two chambers. And the question is, would opponents of the agreement have the ability to override the veto? It's quite clear now, it seems to me, that in the Senate, at least, they're not going to have the ability to override that veto.
No, I mean, you need to think about that, right? I mean, all they need – this isn't a 60-vote filibuster. They need two-thirds.
Right.
I mean, that's what they need to override is veto. And I mean, if you think about it, I think something like 16 or 17 Democrats have already come out strongly in favor of this. Or maybe one of the – or Democratic – leaning, I think maybe one or two of them are Bernie. Well, I know Bernie Sanders is one of them who's not, technically not a Democrat in the Senate, and Angus King, who's not a Democrat. So, my guess is that there's no way they're getting there.
There's no way they're going to get there. But
no, and the fact that Schumer, if what he did was going to give cover, it would have given cover in the couple days after he did
yes.
it. And that was, again, where these groups, to give them credit, were amazing. Because Move On and Credo and all of them were right on it. So we're lefty blogs and other groups and sent direct messages to Schumer saying, to the others saying, this gives you no cover. Do not think that just that because Chuck Schumer did this, that suddenly you got, we will be coming after you to expose your role in this. And it's supported by a majority of the population,
yep,
and an even bigger majority of a lot of these people's constituents, because a lot of these people are come from, it's the opposite of our usual calculation. Sure, there's a couple from you know, middle parts of the country, but most of the ones who have a problem with it, because they're scared of certain Jewish constituencies, which is ludicrous, because most Jews are in favor of this, are coastals.
Well, right? they're afraid of money. I mean, that's what this is all about.
Yeah, you're right.
Money.
Connecticut senators, it's Cory Booker, it's people, you know, it's Dianne Feinstein. I mean, yep, a whole bunch of the people are those guys. And, I mean, maybe Feinstein isn't running for anything again, but some of the other ones are, certainly. And so
there's a strong correlation between Wall Street and I think
that's a good
too.
Point. I mean, it's Wall Street tied.
And so the interesting thing about it, as far as, you know, one can track these things, you had Schumer. These groups immediately basically sucked up that oxygen and did not allow Schumer's act to provide cover. Schumer starts off by saying, hey, I'm going to whip this. So it's not just like I'm going to vote this way. He says, I'm going to try and convince my colleagues. Then we see a pushback where you see basically the at the beginning, no one's questioning whether or not Schumer should be the leader. And then you start to see people sort of say, like, well, I mean, I think Ernst in the White House said, well, this is now a decision for other senators to make about whether or not he's a legitimate person to be the leader. And then you start to see you got to send out, you know, Evan Bay and those type of folks to say, like, no, Chuck Schumer, defending Schumer. And then
on Fox, I'm sure he did it on Fox, too, because he's a contributor there. They try to come out and say, like, Lieberman or whatever, but that's the key thing, is that what, you know, they've gotten a couple of, you know, Democrat-ish types who are no longer in office. They have not yet, again, unless something's happening this morning while we're speaking, you know, McCaskill was on the fence, not surprising. A few others, you know, have come out and said, but I have not seen one other go along with him yet. And every day that goes by further between when he said it and when they do it, there's less cover. So I really do think that, you know, that you may only get a couple Democrats against it. You may get really, you may end up sort of easily beating this thing by a number of votes, which is amazing. So,
well, the real question now to me, okay, at this point is, does this impact Chuck Schumer's role as a presumptive next leader of the Democrats in the Senate?
You need somebody credible, like in all the time. It's sort of similar to the dynamics of when we want to primary somebody, which, by the way, Schumer is up. Is he up in 16 or 18? I'm just saying there's a terrific law professor with a kind of weird name who gave Cuomo a run for his money in New York. And I think there are lots of people thinking, can we get her in that race? I mean, if Zephyr Teachout were willing to get into that race, that would be – I mean, look at what she did with Cuomo with no money.
Right.
You get a lot of money behind her. I mean, yeah, Chuck Schumer has $20 million or something in the bank because he's Wall Street's favorite guy. There's no way you're ever become close to matching him, but I don't know that you have to. So that would be interesting. But in terms of the dynamics in the Senate, that also has to be looked at like a primary race, which is you need someone else willing to stand up.
Right.
Will Dick Durbin do that?
No.
Do people want Dick Durbin? I don't know. You know, I mean, he wasn't so good on Social Security. I don't know who else ends up being the person who would do it, so I think it has to be him. And I think what you need is you need at least one or two. You know, Bernie Sanders won't do it. He's running for president, and he doesn't want to cause trouble within his own caucus, and I wouldn't blame him for that. You need one or two reasonable people on the left in the Senate caucus to stand up and say that they will oppose Schumer over this and vote for somebody else. That's how the dam breaks. You know, I don't know if it ends up being – you know, what's his name? It ends up being Merkley. I don't know if it ends up being Sherrod Brown. I don't know if it ends up being Al Franken. I don't know who it is. But it has to be somebody of that ilk. Tammy Baldwin, maybe.
Yeah,
somebody,
but I mean,
like,
is Tammy Baldwin going to be the Senate majority or minority leader? I mean,
they don't need to stand up and say they're running. They need to stand up and say, I'm going to support Dick Durbin or whoever the alternative is. And if you get three or four of them to stand up and say, I'm supporting the same person, whoever that alternative is, suddenly the dynamics change a lot.
And I'll tell you something. There was an interesting piece. Josh Marshall wrote a piece today. And, you know, Josh Marshall is not the leader of the Democratic Party. But it's interesting to see a guy like that come out and say, this is disqualifying to Chuck Schumer. And it's also interesting, I see a piece yesterday talking about Chuck Schumer on the phone to his colleagues, not so much to whip them to vote against the deal, but to sort of justify his vote against the deal. What's going to be interesting is...
Yeah, isn't that funny? When you read, I read that too, and I'm like, I thought at first, oh my God, this guy is actually calling and lying. Right. He's going to get killed. And I read it, and I'm like, oh, that's not what he's doing.
He's
calling and begging for forgiveness.
Yes. And that's a good dynamic. I like that dynamic.
Yeah.
If we can't get Schumer out, I definitely want him to feel like he owes people who are not interested in war. You know what I mean? I mean, it really does show a tremendous amount of weakness in this area. With that said, you know, I don't know once this deal gets passed, frankly, if it's an area that
is
going to be...
people are going to hold it against Schumer after that. They may just let it...
Right, it just may not be as relevant.
If they knock the thing down, then that would be... there'd be hell to pay. But if it just passes anyhow, I think some Democrats will make an excuse. And remember the line we were just talking about for Joe Lieberman? Mm. He's with us, but everything, you know, on everything but the war. And the truth is Schumer is closer to being with us on more things than Lieberman was, except the war, except for the, I mean, he's obviously terrible on any kind of transaction tax or closing, you know, the carried interest loophole or anything that would make billionaires pay a little bit more money than, you know, in taxes than their secretaries do. But and I'm not saying that means I want him there. I actually agree with Josh Marshall. Because I'm tired of – there are at least, I'd say, a half dozen to a dozen major issues where the party is today. And if you look at who the leaders were before this, things have, in the end, have turned out pretty good, I think, with Harry Reid. But there was a while there where he was very anti-choice. He was A-rated from the NRA, you know, where he was against a number of major issues that were important to Democrats. Same with Tom Daschle before him. And because of the states they were in, that made things even more complicated. Nevada didn't used to be the – you know, center, almost leaning left state it is today.
Right.
And, you know, whereas at least Schumer's from New York, so you have that. But you want somebody to be a leader who at least, you know, they don't have to be with you on every issue, but the major ones. This is not hard either. I mean, he's been wrong. He's been just as wrong in foreign policy as every person who we criticize on this show and everywhere else. Every one of the Bill Kristol types and the rest of them that we ream, you know, he voted for Iraq. He's against this. You know what I mean? During a lot of those Iraq debates, he always seemed to be on the, once we do a surge, the whole thing will just work out by itself. And, I mean, you know, he seemed to be in la-la land on a lot of this stuff, you know. And I don't remember, maybe you remember, but my guess is he probably was pushing for us to bomb Syria too, which would have made a lot of sense to bomb the people who are fighting ISIS. I mean, which is a part of our whole problem over there is that we can't decide from one to the next whose side we're actually on.
Right.
I hope it's disqualifying. I think it should be. I think this is too big for this not to be. I think this is as big as, you know, if he had opposed health care, if he, you know, opposed the stimulus. I mean, there's only so many major votes that I think are definitive for the left and center of the party to come together on that are clearly supported by a majority of Americans clearly makes sense. And he's wrong.
That's why I got to say, look, it's great for these outside groups to be maintaining the pressure, for people to keep the pressure on Schumer, because at the very least, you weaken him and he owes some favors to the sort of growing progressive caucus in the Senate. Cliff, we don't have time to go over Jeb Bush's stuff really in great detail, but let me play, because I want to talk about this, because there was a great McClatchy piece.
Yep.
Where, you know, I know you remember this. McClatchy was one of the few news organizations back in the run-up to the Iraq War in 2002-2003,
Got it right.
That was reporting, like, the skepticism that was really out there. And they had a piece about Jeb Bush's speech on foreign policy, specifically Iraq, the other day, which was fantastic, entitled Jeb Bush Offered Inaccurate Version of Iraq War History. And this is the thing that we work, you know, we talk about all the time, which is if a politician gets up there and says something that is demonstrably untrue, it should be reported as not he said this, but that he said something demonstrably untrue.
Right.
And they did that,
that
with
Shorenstein
this
piece. That you and I went over 2 weeks ago or whenever. Exactly.
And so let's play this clip. It's 2 minutes, and Matthew Film Guy is waiting in the wings, and we will get to him in a moment. And he's pissed, man. But let's get to this. This is Jeb Bush. He is speaking at the Americans for Peace, Prosperity, and Security Forum, likely story, at St. Ambrose University in Davenport, Iowa. Here is a series of clips. We may stop these as we go. Here it is.
I'll tell you, though, that taking out Saddam Hussein turned out to be a pretty good deal. In 2009, Iraq was fragile but secure.
All right, pause it. We've got to address that. It was a pretty good deal taking out Saddam Hussein. $3 trillion later, and counting, because, of course,
we have to go through all the things that were wrong with how they did that yet again, how we got there, or how they behaved once we were there.
But let's just go. Let's just do a cost benefit analysis. I mean, hundreds of thousands of innocent Iraqis dead. Four or 5,000 U.S. military personnel dead that we know of. We have incredible instability in that region. We have empowered Iran.
We empowered Maliki, who, I mean, if you want the truth of what happened there, who always had been sectarian and then went in and went after the Sunnis in a manner in which he had always done. And what, you know, when he's sitting there talking about the creation of ISIS, perhaps that was some of the reason that we caused that destabilization and then supported al-Maliki. Or could it have been that we allowed Bremer, when he was over there in the green zone, to basically take all the de-Baathization and kick all these guys out of the army, so they had all these Sunnis, so they had no jobs? There's a whole lot of reasons that led to ISIS, none of which have anything to do with anybody in the world except for members of George Bush's family, who seem to be the only ones who ever get us into wars in the Middle East. But go ahead.
Let's let Jeb Bush continue.
Jeb Bush's family. Sorry. Go ahead.
Mission was accomplished in the way that there was security there, and it was because of the heroic efforts of the men and women in the United States military that it was so. And that is a fact, and you can't take that away from anybody who served, and you can't take that away from, you can't rewrite history in that regard. It was important to create a secure situation so that the Iraqi people felt like there was progress being made, that they weren't scared to walk the streets. And the decision to abandon, to dismantle the Iraqi army was a mistake. And I think my brother would admit that today. But when we got to that point and we saw the chaos, he had the courage to do something that was completely against the political grain. There was no one other than John McCain and a few others that believed that the surge was the right thing to do. Now people take credit for the surge when they were opposed to it during its implementation. And I think it's one of the great success stories in modern military history, that David Petraeus and the incredible fighting force did what they did to create a very secure situation out of total chaos. I do think, in general, that torture is not appropriate, it's not as effective, and the change of policy that my brother did and then was put into executive order form by the president was the proper thing to do. I also would say that right after 9/11, I mean, we were attacked, and
all right, I don't need to hear any more of his justifying. Like, yeah, you so you know, at the one point, where we needed to maintain our laws about
how many
torture.
Lies can you fit into one?
First off,
stupid things.
Mission accomplished.
First of all, you said,
mission accomplished. I am holding right now. I am holding right now, Cliff. My George Bush mission accomplished doll with him from the flight deck. The idea that he could say mission was accomplished by 2009
right.
is
Didn't somebody tell him
hilarious.
Never use those words again? They've been banished from the Republican linguistics. I mean, the fact that he could get up related to that war and use those words in any way is just amazing. And then he goes on from there and spins this tale about, you know, and of course he turns it into nobody can say that it wasn't, you know, wasn't a success and whatever. You can't tell the servicemen that, right? He turns it into what
right.
they always try to do, which is you're attacking the servicemen and women if you point out the fact that this was a failure. Yeah, I, by the way, you know, the surge, it didn't accomplish anything because we had no strategy for doing anything after that. It, of course, never should have had to happen because we never should have been there based upon your family's lies. But taking that aside, what did it accomplish in the end? You know, all we did in the end was, again, support al-Maliki and you know.
Well, that's exactly the point. I mean, it may have bought us another 18 months without less hostilities. But the bottom line is, once we entered there, the where we're at now was inevitable. You could have, I guess, kept Americans in that country for another 50 years, but I would argue that the 18 months after you take us out of there, you're going to have the same problem.
Let me say quickly, because I know we got to go, throwing aside all other considerations here, all right? So let's take out whether it was right, this would be correct to do culturally, you know, in any other way, because there's clearly a lot of arguments against doing this. But the only way this would ever work, the only way we've ever gone in and invaded a country with a distinctly separate culture from our own, and you know, and been there and made it and you know, were there long enough so that it became a functioning and strong democracy. The only time I can think of is Japan. And that's because we're still there. And that's because we pumped millions of dollars into the country. We were willing to rebuild all sorts of things. So, yeah, I mean, we could have made Iraq work if we set a 2060 pullout date and we spent trillions upon trillions of dollars building schools, rebuilding universities, building medical facilities, doing all sorts of things, maybe instituting a policy of giving each family a certain amount of money and reparations for what we did to their property and everything. Yeah, then you might buy goodwill and maybe you could set the place on a course towards democracy. Were we ever willing to undertake that?
No.
And do that? No.
Well, of course, and we can't. And
well,
you know, any
can,
more
should,
any
yeah.
more than we could say, let's wait for the unicorn fairies to come down and fix the whole thing. I mean, I guess theoretically we also could have made them annexed them and made them a state. And
yeah, had them join NATO, you know.
All that aside, we'll put a link to that McClatchy piece because it just goes by point by point. And it's nice to see that kind of reporting where a lie is called a lie. We've got to go, Cliff. But
yes. We've overstepped our time period here.
Matthew Film Guy is just enraged. Cliff, as always, a pleasure. We'll talk to you next week.
All right. Thanks for having me on, as always, buddy.
Bye-bye. Bye. All right, folks, going to take a quick break. When we come back, Matthew Film Guy will be sitting next to me in studio. In other words, we're going to take a break here.
You know.
We are back. Sam Cedar on the Majority Report. Ladies and gentlemen, joining me in studio, the guy. Oh, I guess you were not paying attention. You don't have his theme song?
Uh-oh. I wasn't mad before.
No, your mic is also not up.
Hello? Am I talking into it?
Yeah. Go ahead. I got some music.
Here. Let's hear it.
Matthew, the film guy, is choosing your streams. Cassavetes on Netflix and other such themes. Maybe you'll watch one and learn a few things. Please recommend me a movie to stream. Matthew, please recommend me a movie to stream. Matthew, film guy.
Ladies and gentlemen, I was also remiss, and I can't believe this didn't come up in my conversation with Cliff, that today is the 80th anniversary of the signing by FDR of the Social Security Act. 80 years ago today. And to celebrate, we've brought in Matthew Filmguy.
It also happens to be the 27th anniversary of my bar mitzvah today.
Wow.
So, coincidence?
I don't
think so.
27th anniversary since your bar mitzvah?
That's right.
Damn.
Wait a second.
That's right.
Where's the shofar at?
Oh, yeah, there you go.
The obvious hook there. Thank you.
So, wait, is it your birthday?
So, yes, that's right, Sam. Next week, I will be turning 40.
Wow.
Really? You're going to be 40?
That's right. Now, I made it.
Happy pre-birthday,
it's
bro.
It's interesting that you came in today because I thought the rage, I guess that's more with like the early 30s, was when it's your birthday to just sort of mosey on into work.
Well, it's not today's not my actual birthday. It's next Wednesday.
Okay.
And I'm actually going on vacation.
You right into that.
Yeah, I did. I was.
Okay.
I'm actually going on vacation out to Ohio to hang out with some old friends to celebrate.
Well, and, you do mean old, too.
Yeah.
Really old
yeah,
friends.
Yeah, they're all older than me, so they're 40 plus.
Wow, that is old.
I was the youngest. Yeah, they're really.
What's going on with his mic?
Hello?
It's just how he speaks into it sometimes.
Okay. No, I have not moved. I have not moved. Hello. Okay. Now I can hear me. So.
Hello.
So, yes, they are old. Not quite as old as you. Right. I'll always be younger than you by a little bit, but I'm catching up.
Yes, it
you used to be quite older.
It does seem like you are catching up.
Yeah. Yeah. No gray hairs yet, but, you know, I expect that any minute now.
It comes hard after 40. It comes hard and fast.
Well, that's why Mary and I are taking a Taekwondo now. We're trying to get more physically active in our old age.
You know what? So. That's a good idea. I made the mistake of I had moved quite far along in Taekwondo. I don't know if you recall that. Yes.
I didn't recall it was Taekwondo.
It was Taekwondo. I was actually a brown belt.
Wow, that is
and
advanced.
And when I was 35, decided that this is the last opportunity for me to box.
Uh-huh.
But I said, you know, I'm already doing Taekwondo. Why should I just box? What I should do is Thai kickboxing.
That's seriously
not Thai
hardcore.
And it is seriously hardcore.
That's
I went
insane.
To that gym that used to be on 5th Avenue and 28th Street.
Jimmy's?
No, it was a real gym. Thai kickboxing gym.
Okay.
And within 2 days, I had destroyed my back.
Oh, wow.
And I went to go play basketball after, you know, the way you kick in that is just crazy. I went to go play basketball, and ever since that day, it took me about 6 months to rehabilitate my back, but I still have a problem that when I drop my neck like this, left knee goes numb.
So there's some sort of spinal. Have you seen a chiropractor? I threw that into the mix too.
I will not do that ever.
It feels good. They just go.
Yeah.
I get scared for a second. They're like, get ready. I'm like, no. Oh.
Not going to do that.
But then it feels good.
Matthew Filmguy.
Yes, Sam. That is me.
What have you been up to as of late?
Apart from contemplating my own mortality with the approaching of my 40th birthday?
Yes. Are you going through some serious questioning of your life choices?
No, you
I'm not suggesting you should. I'm just wondering if that's coming.
I didn't think you were until you said that. But no, I'm actually not. I feel actually pretty good in in my life situation. I'm feeling more relaxed. You know, as you get a little older, you kind of, I think you you have one of two options. You either sort of achieve escape velocity from the sort of neuroses of your past and you're free of the sort of worries of the ego, or you, you know, crash down terribly and kind of wallow and fester and go into bitterness and anger. And I think I'm in the stratosphere at this point.
Really?
Yeah.
So are you suggesting that you cannot drop back down into the atmosphere?
You know, give me a couple more orbits and we'll see if I can maintain. You know, you still maybe you run out of fuel, to continue the metaphor. But no, I'm feeling good. Life with Mary is great. You know, she's also going to be turning 40 a little bit later this year. So we're going on a nice cruise vacation. You know, Mary plays poker. So we're going on the World Poker Tour cruise. And we're looking forward to that. And we're, you know.
Now, wait, do you want to talk about that? I don't know if you've talked about that on this
poker
program. Yes. Have you talked about that?
I may have mentioned it, but yeah, we could talk about that. She's amazing. She shows up to these poker tournaments and they all look at her and see this sort of cute young girl and don't take her seriously. And the next thing you know, she's finishing in the final table like almost every time. So, and her family is a very hardcore poker family. They have a Christmas tournament where they actually have a cup with their names on it and everything. And she's won that several times. So she's serious. It's possibly an income stream.
I was going to say, like, are you now living off the earnings?
Not yet. She's still, I'd say, training, but I'm a big supporter of her. And this cruise offers, like, workshops and things like that with poker professionals. So it's going to be all part of the fun and games of doing that.
Oh, my God. So what do you do? Now, do you sit, like, is this like a, like, I mean, I what was the Bond movie? Where
yeah,
he was playing
exactly. Casino Royale.
Do you come up behind her, like wearing something, you know, looking dapper as an attempt to like distract people?
Yeah,
other players.
It works. I show an extra little chest hair, and they go like, "What is that guy doing? Oh, I should have raised." And they, yeah. Actually, we watched that scene in Casino Royale to analyze the poker moves. We watched it like several times.
Yeah, and what was the?
I can't remember, but they take it pretty seriously. They actually, you see most of the cards that they're playing there. But she usually goes off, and I don't usually always go with her. She plays in this New York Free Poker Tour where the winners get like seats to other tournaments and stuff like that. So it's, I don't always go with her.
So now what are you going to do on this cruise? Are you just going to be basically like sitting behind her as she's getting these lessons? Or are you going to be out by, what is there? What are you doing
on the cruise? I'm bringing books. I'll finally start reading Debt. I figure I could get through that maybe.
Cool.
You know
what else?
Some big stuff. I've always wanted to read this Robert Anton Wilson book that's been sitting on my shelf for years. I've got some just like paperback Star Trek novels. I'm just going to bring a big stack of stuff.
I hope you. Now, are you not? Do you not have like a Kindle or something like that? Or no, you don't do it that way.
You know, I do. I sort of mix and match. But going on a cruise, sitting outside, I want to bring like a real actual book. So I actually just bought
to impress people.
Yeah, just so if anybody walks by, they don't just think maybe he's reading Star Trek or maybe he's reading, you know, Engels.
I would recommend Guy Lawson's latest. Also, I would recommend.
I have a lot of catching up to do. I have a huge stack.
Ta-Nehisi Coates.
That's what the president's reading, I understand.
Well,
I don't want to.
Now, have we spoken since?
I need to read
Ta-Nehisi. The Obama Marin thing.
No, we haven't.
Oh my!
And we haven't spoken since the Cedar Marin thing. I just binged watched
your
the Marin episodes.
Your sitcom, the sitcom appearance.
That's right. I was on vacation.
Yeah.
Oh my gosh! Wow. Yeah.
And I thought you were great. Mary and I both agreed you should be an actor.
Well, there was a time. There was indeed a time. Let's revisit that. I hadn't realized that we hadn't talked about that. I think most people know that when I went out to L.A. in February, I was going out to shoot an episode of Marin's show, of his TV show, and then at the end of that week, after we were a little more sentimental, I think, after that week, because it was sort of a fun week to do that. We sat down in the garage so that I could basically pave the way for the president to go there, because the president wasn't going to go unless I had sort of provided him the oxygen and the cover to go into the garage.
I need my pregame Jew.
That's
that's right.
I smell some Jew in here.
I don't need to read Ta-Nehisi Coates' book to know that the white man's the devil. I've been saying that for years.
Yeah.
So, wake up, America.
I understand that Mark actually has your coffee cup under a glass right next to the president's.
That's very possible.
Did you know that?
Why? Did he put the president's cup?
Yes, he has it under. He tweeted a picture of it under like a glass dome.
Oh, that's
funny.
Because
he left his branded presidential seal cup.
Oh, the paper cup. Oh, that's funny.
Have a little dignity.
So the episode was ostensibly the podcast, The Patent Troll, which came out of, I mean, I don't know if people recall this, but on the day I got the letter, the next day we had Julie Samuels, I think it was, from the EFF on the program, and I put her in touch with Maron, who obviously had a lot more of a stake in this. I mean, and a much bigger audience, and they were out in L.A. with the other people, and basically it went from there. And then this episode was ostensibly about this. Now, a lot of people basically said to me, like, they were like, wow, dude. I mean, I had different responses from people, like...
Yeah, I heard some of the responses, and I didn't get... I thought you were a very sympathetic character throughout the whole thing.
Some people thought I came off as very, very nudgy.
No, I mean, maybe because I'm a Jew as well, but I thought you were...
Well, I was playing a guy who was a little bit more aggressive than myself.
Yes,
in that
I caught that, and it played well, and it made sense. You know, Maron does set himself up to be the sort of idiot in the scene a lot, and I think that's how that was written, that he's, like, not taking it seriously, sort of self-involved and only cares about it once it involves him.
Right.
And, you know, yes, we have that scene where you're like, we've got to do this, and we've got to do that, and we've got to, you know. But
right.
Nothing you said seemed like we're supposed to think of you as a lunatic, just as a...
A little bit
engaged.
Overly zealous, perhaps,
or just realistically engaged.
Right.
You know, I thought I was waiting for it to be more nudgy from hearing about it, and I thought it was nudgy.
No,
light.
I didn't think. Yeah, I mean, I think I think they could have written me a lot more, but there was like
you
a couple of moments where Maron was like, look, you always got mad at me for not being in politics. And my character didn't have the opportunity to address that. Like, I don't give a crap what you did.
Right. That read as Maron's own voice talking to himself.
Exactly.
Yeah, but that's,
there was a healthy dose of that in there. Now it's ironic because today I started to listen to Maron interview Chris Hayes.
Oh, yeah, I haven't listened to that yet.
And
how's that make you feel?
That's fine. What really annoyed me was his intro of the show, where this whole thing of, like, I'm not for bringing people, you know, putting people apart. I'm for bringing people together. And, I don't need to put a wedge between them with politics.
There Who says is, that? Maron says
Maron
that?
Says that at the beginning of the episode. He doesn't say it directly to Hayes. And that sentiment... I find to be so enraging because it basically says there are no political differences unless I recognize them.
Right, exactly.
Right? Like they, or I should say, there are no political differences. There's only the imposition of political differences.
It's that group. What's that group you guys always
Well, it's no labels.
No
it's
labels,
third
exactly.
way.
It's no
this.
Labels. It's stupid.
But in the case of Maron and others like him who will say this, like, look, I have no problem. You don't want to focus on politics? That's fine. It's debatable as to whether or not there's, you know, you have a certain responsibility to engage, but that's fine, and particularly professionally.
Right.
But the idea that people who are engaged in politics are polarizing people...
Just by nature.
By nature, or that otherwise people would come together... is a farce.
Yeah.
It's a farce. There are real life implications for these things. And
the point he's making is at best sort of inconsequential, because maybe it's true that the people who get engaged have a personality quirk that makes them a little bit more interested in confrontation or able to handle it or feeling that they need to impose their worldview on other people, whereas other people lay back and just like, whatever. So maybe there's something
well,
to that.
Well, that may be true. But there are people who do that in the world.
Right, and that's why you have some people who are politicians and some people who are this and some people who are that. Enterprise itself is still necessary. And I think the show actually did something to show that. He's just like, you said, like, welcome to politics. Like,
right.
You know, it's an awakening in him to realize that, oh, politics actually does affect my life. And there are implications to these things. It's not just I like to get on the mic and yell at people.
Right.
Which is just a, you know, it's just a bonus there.
Right. That is just a bonus.
Yeah.
That is
yeah.
just that just means I'm well suited to do this
exactly,
show. Right.
Exactly. But that's why we want you on
but
that
But somebody
wall.
Needs to do it.
Yeah, exactly. Somebody needs to do it. And there's ways to achieve your goals. Maybe he has differences of opinion on how you can get through to somebody. Maybe arguing isn't always the best way. Maybe you use the stick less than the carrot or something like that. But it is disingenuous for him to say that all political conversations are just about personality quirks.
Yeah, I can see you're doing your best to defend him. Now, I will also say what is also coincidentally
available season four.
What is also coincidental
available season four
is that I recently did an independent film as an actor again.
Yeah, as a police officer.
As a police officer.
Wow, this is your niche. This is your niche.
It's and now I just want to be a cop.
You drunk with power,
yep.
with even pseudo cop power.
Yep.
So you get it. You see how it happens.
I see how it happens. I feel
yeah.
it. I mean, you put that uniform
yeah,
on.
Get your bike
and
off
you
the
got
street.
The,
yeah.
You got your, you know, you're wearing a gun belt.
Yeah. You're like Batman.
It's like you're a cowboy.
Yeah.
You're a cowboy.
I went to Batman, but yeah, cowboys.
Now, you're not Batman. No.
No. You have a utility belt.
You have a utility belt, but it's really more
like
feel like
a
gun
torch and like acid in there. You just have.
And so what else have you been watching these days, Matthew Film Guy? Been watching? Let me ask you this. You watched the episode of Marin that I starred in. I really did star in.
You sure
it.
Did. Turned on you.
And have you watched Wet Hot American Summer?
No, I have not yet. They were shooting that while we were shooting Bad Situationist, so I've always felt a little bit of
that film.
Yeah,
actually, they film that before we did Bad Situationist.
Did they?
Yes.
Oh, you know, I was thinking of the other UCB thing they were shooting. What was that one? I've all this time held a kind of a grudge against that film, but I enjoyed it. I went to Jewish summer camp, so I easily identify with all the tropes and all of the trappings. But I have not delved into, probably because Mary has no real interest in Jewish summer camp stuff, so we haven't watched that together. I'd have to watch that probably on my own.
I do distinctly remember David Wayne. He was coming to me for advice when he was contemplating doing the movie, and he said he was trying to raise money to do it on film, and I'm like, what? Don't be an idiot. Shoot it on video, dude, because I had shot Who's the Caboose on video.
That's right.
And I was like, big mistake. Big mistake.
Yeah.
You know what's also interesting about
okay
you know what's interesting about Wet Hot American Summer versus, let's say, Who's the Caboose?
What?
Is at the time, both films had a lot of people who were going to go on to a certain amount of celebrity.
Mm-hmm.
And if you had told me in 2003 that, or 2002 even, that the people in Wet Hot American Summer would surpass in terms of career, the people in Who's the Caboose, I would have said you're crazy.
Have they, though?
Oh, yes. I mean, Paul Rudd is in a huge film.
Yeah.
Bradley Cooper, huge film.
Right.
Amy Poehler,
right.
Huge film.
They
huge.
Sarah, David Cross, and Andy Dick, I guess.
Oh, yes.
The next team.
Oh, yeah. Oh, yeah. And
but who's keeping score, really? You know?
Well, no, but I mean, it's you know that's why that's why that film continues to have a really I think as broad appeal as it does.
Well, Who's the Caboose got a 6-episode sequel as well.
That's right, on Trio, but not on Netflix and not with the same.
It didn't exist yet.
You
knows?
Know what I found
Maybe
the other
it was
day
too soon.
Is a it was a review of Pilot Season online. That said, that basically was Pilot Season is great. Too bad nobody's ever going to see it because Trio just got bought and is going to close down in a couple months.
That's unfortunate.
Like literally after we delivered, like within days of us delivering their first narrative TV show, fictional, it was announced that the network was going to close down.
It ruined my team.
Sorry, Mr. Cedar.
I mean, to a certain extent, that is... That has always been my career trajectory,
well,
right?
It ruined my TV acting career.
It did.
I mean, I was counting on that to launch me, and nobody saw it.
I had an offer to be the Keith Olbermann's permanent substitute 4 days before he leaves the network.
Wow. Wow, that's amazing.
Yeah.
There's a book in that or a documentary. Maybe that's what happens to Max in the next phase.
Years ago, I sort of like plotted out what it would be that he
turns to politics. Podcast. Yeah.
Well, not podcast, but politics.
No. Okay. Right. All right. I think that's a good idea. But what have I been watching? You know, I'm actually excited. I haven't started watching it, but I'm excited to watch Documentary Now. Have you seen
yes.
for that?
Yes.
Yeah. Mary and I watched the preview episode where they took the piss out of Vice.
Uh-huh.
Where they're like these Brooklyn hipsters wearing bizarre clothing and, you know, sort of odd facial hair. And they go into somebody's house in South America somewhere. And they're like, oh, my God, look, there's a PlayStation 1. This is terrible. it's like making fun of their like poverty tourism, you know. Right. And actually, Mary brought this point up to me last night, which I thought was very interesting about that. Is that documentary started out as being these sort of ethnographic, you know, sort of you know, I don't know what you call it, like poverty tourism or other tourism by these white people. And Cinema Verite was a response to that. And in a lot of ways, Vice has sort of brought it back to that. Even though I do enjoy the Vice shows and their news pieces, there's something odd about exactly that, a Brooklyn hipster going in and going like, oh, this country is so weird. This country is, what? Oh, my God, you date like that? That's weird. Have you seen those? Have you watched the Vice show?
I've watched some of it. Some of it.
It's worthy. It's interesting topics that other people don't cover. But anyway, so Documentary Now, they're going to spoof a bunch of different documentary genres.
It's Fred Armisen and
Bill Hader from Saturday Night Live. Yeah.
Now, Bill Hader is married to Maggie, right? Isn't her name Maggie? Is that
Maggie who?
She was my assistant on pilot season.
Oh, really?
My real assistant.
Oh, yeah. Yeah,
I think.
I remember her. She was nice.
She was nice. And I think she's now a director. I mean, I haven't seen her in 15 years. No, wait. Well, 10 years, I guess.
And, Gabe in the commercials all the time. You see Gabe is on all these Heineken commercials.
Gabe was the guy who played my...
He was the documentary director.
Oh, yes. He was the documentary director, right, in the...
In
pilot season. Yep. And so,
a lot of nice people.
So you're getting ready to watch this documentary now. Yeah. Have you seen the first episode or you just seen the ads?
Yeah, no, the first episode was like a short preview after Marin's season finale last night.
Okay.
15 minutes.
Oh, I missed hilarious. That. But I will definitely watch it.
It was hilarious. So I'm excited about that. But I've been showing documentaries, you know, in my JCC film class for a while. So I've got
what documentaries are you showing?
Well, the movie I wanted to actually recommend for today is a very, I think, important and unique film that maybe you've heard of called Portrait of Jason.
No.
Okay. This is one of the greatest just films of all time. It happens to be a documentary, but it calls into question the entire enterprise of what a documentary is. It's basically...
Oh, that's... You know I like stuff like that.
Yeah.
That's deconstructive. Yes. Of that basically indicts exactly what you're doing
yes,
at that moment.
Precisely. And this is an early version of it. They made this in the early 60s, directed by a woman named Shirley Clark, who was actually... she was.
What is it called again now?
Portrait of Jason.
Okay.
And it basically consists of one interview with this charismatic, highly entertaining, and yet sort of mysterious... gay hustler, I guess you would call him. He's a black man. So this movie's gotten a lot of attention for its sort of multicultural politics, but that's not the big draw for me. It's sort of celebrated in the gay community because he was a early on-screen gay figure. Apparently, he's also the first person in cinema to do this on screen. So there's these sort of trappings of it that are sort of politically.
I thought
important.
Sam was the first person to do that, actually.
Huh. No, well that's
to really
you.
To fully capture
any,
it,
right?
Yeah. But
To fully capture it, right.
Yeah. But his name is Jason Holliday, which is not even his real name, and he tells the stories of being basically like a gay prostitute as he tries to plot his cabaret one-man show. And this was someone that Shirley Clark knew, and Shirley Clark is a very interesting figure herself. She was from an upper-middle-class Jewish family in Manhattan, but she wound up sort of
in other words,
out.
Like the guys from Vice.
Well, in some ways, but she actually wound up becoming an integral part of sort of the downtown jazz and sort of, African-American art scene. And she made a lot of films before that, like The Connection, which was about based on a play, Waiting for a Heroin Dealer. and The Cool World, which was, yes, it, you could say somewhat of a sort of ethnographic safari for her, but she became a part of that, and she herself was a very much of an outsider, and she was fascinated with these sort of outsider personalities. And Jason Holliday is this guy who tells these incredible stories, and you don't always get the sense that she's sympathetic to him, and you can hear them talking to him behind the camera saying, uh-huh. tell us this story, tell us that story. And if you hear her report back to her on her mindset of making the film, she actually tried to sort of get him. Like, she tried to expose him, and in making the film, she kind of came to understand him and sort of have more sympathy for him. And you go through all these sort
and
of
And why was she trying to expose him?
Because he was this sort of shit-talking kind of... you know, he wasn't a sympathetic character to her. She had apparently her boyfriend, who was an actor who Jason respected. He's also behind the camera a lot of this. His name is Carl Lee, and he was an actor of some fame in the 60s, died sort of young. And apparently they had a dispute, and there was some, you know, interpersonal issues that were real that she had decided that she'd want to sort of confront him with in this film. And that sort of comes in at the end. But she just... knew that he would be this kind of charismatic storyteller that she could talk to, but at the same time, you know,
she was vindictive about.
Yes, at the start.
Well, that's got all the things that I like.
Yes, exactly.
Deconstruction.
Yeah.
Vindictiveness.
Yeah.
Using your medium as a way of punishing
yep.
people.
Yep.
All exactly. of that. All of that sounds attractive.
Yeah, and with a sort of and a low budget nature. You know, John Cassavetes was hugely inspired by Shirley Clarke. She was his sort of predecessor in a lot of ways.
And, interesting.
And she's made, you know, she won a co-won an Oscar for a documentary on Robert Frost, and she had come to some acclaim. And also, you know, just by virtue of her being a woman, she's an interesting figure. But again, apart from all the sort of multicultural
stuff. In terms of filmmaking
stuff,
at that time.
Yeah. But apart from all the sort of multicultural sort of trappings and political sort of groundbreaking, the movie itself is so fascinating. And
it's just an interview?
Yeah. It's she shot in the Hotel Chelsea across like 12 hours, and they're getting him drunk, and they're getting him stoned, and there's all these sort of, you know, asides and stuff. But it's edited down to about an hour and a half. And it's available on iTunes. They just recently renovated it. I actually donated to the campaign to, you know, what do you call it, restore it.
Uh-huh.
And it wasn't available for many years. It was like something you had to get at Kim's Video, you know.
Right.
And it became like an underground classic. And now it's widely available in a very nice new print. So.
And now why are you recommending that one today, Matthew Film Guy?
I just thought it was a movie that you needed to see. It was a movie that I had recently revisited for showing it in my class.
Mm-hmm.
And I was just inspired to come on and talk about it. And I did think that you would respond to it in exactly the way you have. And I couldn't think of anything else.
All right. Well, I think that sounds like a great film. I will probably be able to watch it. Here's the problem that I'm having right now. Nikki and I are just like knee deep in The Americans, and we got to catch up. I mean, I think we're about to catch
up.
That's on
my long list. That show is so good.
It's pretty good.
I will catch up to that. Oh yeah, I just got a message that I meant to remind you that Ingmar Bergman called Portrait of Jason the most remarkable film he had ever seen.
Did Ingmar Bergman just text
yes.
you?
Yes, from beyond the grave. From beyond the grave, I just got a text from Ingmar. Thank you, Ingmar.
Oh my God!
Love you.
That is insane.
Really love you. Actually,
that
no, that
insane.
Was from that was from Ryan Sarnowski, someone I'm making that other podcast with, the film podcast.
Oh
yeah. Oh, didn't mean to bring it down. Wow. It was Ingmar Bergman.
Wow.
He had to interrupt playing chess with death too.
Very subtle way of reminding us that you're doing another podcast.
It's still in the incubator, so it hasn't come out yet.
Oh gosh. The old
find me on Twitter.
Perennial incubator story. Yeah. Oh, we have heard that. Well, Matthew Film Guy, why don't you hang around while I guess we're gonna do a Freebie Friday today, right?
Yeah,
I'd love
that. We'll go
was
for another
song that
10
we
minutes.
Were supposed to play.
Oh, didn't we get a song?
I'm not sure. I thought somebody
yes,
teased
somebody
it.
Had let's take a phone call. Would you put my computer up, please? We're going to go to you call him from a 614 area code. Who's this?
Hey, this is Brian Ohio.
It's. I'm sorry. Could you say that again?
I'm sorry. It's Brian from Columbus, Ohio.
Yeah, Ryan. You got to talk into your phone.
Is he like sneaking a call at work?
What's that?
Are you at a call center?
No.
Are you at work?
Sorry. Yeah, it's my work.
Okay.
So, anyways, I'm calling in response to what Bronson had called in about yesterday about the FDA, and specifically about the drug issues that come up with the FDA.
Yeah. Let me just remind people of what the case he was making. He was making the case that. The FDA may or may not save people from harmful drugs, but by keeping life-saving drugs off the market, the net effect of the FDA is to cost lives.
How does he know that?
Correct. And I think, my big issue is that I work in the food industry as a quality assurance manager. And I think that when I listened to Bronson's argument, it made me upset because he didn't acknowledge what the F stands for FDA, which is food regulation.
And
I can.
You're not going to address directly the drug part, but you're going to say, well, you're not going to claim. Now, wait a second. You're not going to claim that in some way the FDA prevents people from getting food poisoning, and that has a net positive impact versus all the foods. The old foods, moldy foods, the salmonella-laced foods that we could be eating that would be heavily discounted, and then we could all...
Dude, there is technology in Singapore that could bring people back to life through friggin' jelly beans, all right? And your government bureaucracy is sitting on it, and I can't take it anymore.
Go ahead.
Right. And I have to say, the FDA is allegedly an antagonist to me in my job. They're the one, they're the boogeyman in the background, but I am thankful every day that they're there.
And why
ultimately the
why as a quality control guy of a where do you work?
We do dry foods. We have big blenders and we produce food every day.
Okay. So as a quality control guy, why would you be happy about the FDA? Because I imagine they are quashing your business. I mean, they are the iron grip of regulation.
Right. They are holding us to account. They're holding all of our suppliers to account, and they're holding all of our customers to account. So every step of the way, they're ultimately the ones that are laying down food safety. And without them, it wouldn't be there.
Because it would be a race to the bottom. Is that what you're saying?
Yeah, it would be a race to the bottom. If they didn't force us to hold ourselves to a higher standard, there would be no standard, and more people would get sick, and way more people would die every year.
But I mean, if there was no FDA, wouldn't the market punish you for putting out food with like salmonella?
Well, I'll tell you something. If you go look at the Peanut Corporation of America, in which they are considering sentencing the CEO to life in prison directly, and I hope to goodness that's the sentence he gets. But that was an instance in which the market actor was absolutely defying the law to make sure that his product gets out. It's horrible to have to recall stuff. It's horrible. It's very expensive. And you can have a business.
He knew, just to let people know this, he knew that there was salmonella in that peanut butter, and he just said, ship it anyways.
Well, worse than that, he was working with somebody at a testing agency to make sure that they would be testing until they found no salmonella.
Well, I won't be buying that peanut butter anymore if I'm alive.
That's right. The market. Yeah, exactly. And I just want to say lastly.
Oh, my kid's dead?
And I know it's an issue that you guys haven't touched on a tremendous amount, but the Food Safety Modernization Act of 2011, FSMA Act, is probably to me one of the greatest things that the Obama administration and the Democratic Congress did before they lost control of the government in 2011, before they lost the Congress.
I don't even know what that is.
And that act is, yeah, exactly. The Food Safety Modernization Act of 2011 is just this profound and wonderful thing that has happened. And it's sort of off the radar. But it's in the food industry, it is the most important thing.
I'm going to look into
it. It gave the FDA a tremendous amount of power to further regulate the industry. It was something that desperately needed.
Interesting.
It's a huge thing. Please do look into it. Well, thank you so much.
Appreciate the call. Great call.
Yeah, look into that for me, Sam. I like to.
I will indeed. That's what I
That's what you do.
Am here for.
You can find someone to argue about it with a bit.
Let's go to the IMs. Mailman, I tried to call in but got stuck in this party line with these two old guys going on about the good old days. Forgot what I wanted to write about. Oops. The DX Fool, also. Per Wikipedia, Bill Hader is married to Maggie Carey. Yes, Mary Carey, right. Best known for the movie of The To-Do List and The Janine Tate Show. Her and her UCB work. Once again, no mention of you. Well, I mean, she just... I get it. That song is too long. 3 minutes is too long to send in for a song. We can't do a 3-minute song. Yeah, Maggie was just she was very talented. She was a much better assistant. I feel like I totally upgraded, and she wasn't acting, but I hired you as an assistant on A Bad Situationist and then had you play a character of my assistant.
Yeah.
She was like a genuinely great assistant.
Yes. Yes, you deserve better, Sam. You really did.
I know. Loki. FYI, the Casino Royale poker scenes, especially the final one, widely panned by the poker community.
Huh, interesting. I'd like to hear why.
Zhej Garzlay, do you think Bernie thinks he can actually win? Are you skeptical that he's willing to support corporatist Hillary Clinton if he fails and therefore deliver greater support for her neoliberal agenda? Is he bad for grassroots movements? I'll take the first question last. And the last question first. No, he's good for grassroots movements, in my estimation. I think he's I think that they, as far as I can tell, when I've talked to people who have been to these meetings that were set up last round, that it is really geared towards building a movement and building a network of people.
Votes to Hillary.
Yeah, I mean, I guess theoretically you could say people are sheep, and if Bernie Sanders tells them all to go vote for Hillary, they're going to vote for Hillary. But, I mean, I don't think people work that way.
Kill the white man. That's
Bernie X.
Kill him until he is dead.
Bernie X.
That's the fundamental mission of this campaign.
I would love Bernie Sanders to be president. I would really prefer Hillary Clinton to any of the Republicans running.
You know, I've been actually engaging with, do you know the actor Martin Donovan? He was in Hal Hartley's movies, and he's sort of been a character actor for the last 25 years.
Yeah, I think so.
He's extremely sort of, he's like a Marxist, basically, and I've been sort of engaging with him, and his point is actually that Bernie is more of the same, that he's just going to drive the
No, that's a fight that's been happening in the socialist community.
Yeah.
Some people argue that point right there, that he is...
he's actually destroying movements because you think, oh, this one person will save us, and then you're less likely to, I don't know, join an actual activist group or, you know, something.
Yeah,
like that.
I don't buy that.
He also thinks he doesn't actually think he can win.
I wouldn't be surprised if Sanders is not sure that he can win. Mm-hmm. But I think it's also very possible that once you start getting like 25,000 people to come out to a rally, you start thinking like maybe I could win.
Yeah.
I can't burn down the white power structure in this one campaign. Maybe I can take the white man
but
out.
But I don't
shed.
Know that that's his agenda. I mean, I really do think that he entered this race to make to bring certain issues to the forefront. And I think he's going to have more opportunity to do that going forward, actually, particularly in the debates.
And I remember him saying, I'm not getting into this race unless I think I can win, right? Before people were asking him, like, are you going to get into it? Didn't he say, like, I don't want this just to
and
be
look,
like a vanity thing?
One never knows. I mean, one just never knows.
He's enough in the realm where you can plausibly say one never knows,
right?
Like Sam's saying. So he's not, it's a highly unlikely, but he's not in the like Jill Stein, Dennis Kucinich. Like this just isn't going to happen.
He's not another Kucinich.
There is a realm of possibility that this is entered.
It could catch fire. It could
and build. I think it's the opposite of a vanity campaign. I mean, whether you agree or disagree with him, he clearly wants people to not just simply vote for Hillary Clinton. I mean, I'm sure he would prefer they do, but he wants people. I mean, think about people starting to run for a city council race because of this. People running for a local election. I mean, there, even Howard Dean's campaign produced some of that. Mm. And that was not a left-wing campaign like Bernie Sanders, as far as I understand, yeah, besides Iraq. Mm-hmm. But so I just think sometimes some of the criticism is just – some of it's valid, but some of it's very knee-jerk and very predictable. And it would be said about anybody.
It's a lot more idealistic. You know, it's these grander Marxist critiques of the entire political process.
And that's great.
Yeah.
But okay.
Right. But meanwhile,
what are you going
to
do?
You know, yeah, we had Bhaskar Sunkara on, and maybe it's a good time to have him back on. I guess it was now a year or two ago. But, you know, I think his attitude is one of he is the, I should say, the editor and publisher, I think, or at least the publisher of The Jacobin. And his attitude is, you know, we're not ready to have the socialist revolution right now.
Yeah.
So the idea is to start, you know, introducing people to those ideas and getting them involved in the process. And in the meantime, mitigate the damage that, you know, reactionary forces.
That's what he says, exactly. And I think even in New York, regardless of what you think of de Blasio, it's a very different conversation to be disagreeing with a mayor who at least is talking about inequality.
Right.
And trying to address some issues versus someone who's actually actively hostile to it. Let me
get to an IM here. Netflix recommendation: 30 for 30, Miracles of Men, of Miracles and Men. It is about the Russian hockey team that lost. Miracle on Ice. Incredible story would dovetail nicely with the study, The America's Diet. I feel like I've seen part of that. Caribbean Dancer. How did you get into the film industry, Sam? I don't know that I ever got into the film industry. I think I just got out of it.
By being Sarah's boyfriend, right?
Yeah, exactly. I just stumbled into a lot of the stuff. I was doing voiceovers. I moved down to New York. I immediately had some very quick success in voiceovers. I was performing in a room in New York. I followed Sarah out to LA. Out of that performance in New York, I got called in an audition for All American Girl. It was the first audition I ever had for a TV show. I booked it. And then I went in prepared to have like a test for that show. Got an agent at William Morris off of that because they were like, that doesn't happen.
Mm-hmm.
Where somebody without representation is about to get an ABC sitcom. And then I just parlayed that into other sitcoms. You know, once you get in, particularly at that time, and I mean, the timing was also, I was very lucky. There was all of a sudden, like in those, the year prior, 2 years, three new, like, sitcom buyers. There was a time there were six major networks, UPN, mm-hmm. WB, mm-hmm. Fox, mm-hmm. ABC, CBS, NBC. And so I just went on a tear and it started to get booked at a couple of movies as an actor,
yada yada,
and then I just spent my own money.
Right,
that was it. Basically,
yada yada yada. You're a guest on Mark Maron's show.
Bingo. And I'm sitting here talking to you, MR fan. 1989. Hey guys, happy 80th Social Security. I'll admit the idea of Joe Liability Man being back in political spheres sickened me. The main reason Japan was partially successful is not just because we were there, but also because the institutions for democracy were there previously established in 1889, 1890. It's a long topic, Sam, which I should probably email, but if we didn't allow their participation and rebuilt Japan in our image, that country would have fallen. And Japan would have become a sea of red flags. So we got to monitor our food. Happy Friday, boys. Let's go to the phones. You call them from a 484 area code. Who's this?
Hi, this is Kevin out of PA. I was called in to, you probably already talked about it, the Bronson thing yesterday about the drugs and everything from pharmaceutical companies. And I think from my healthcare perspective is that there's a couple like medications that had to be taken off the market specifically because they did the opposite of what they're supposed to do. I'm talking specifically about things called Vioxx, which was supposed to be,
yep,
was being used for people who had heart attacks, and in fact it caused people to have more heart attacks, or like in worsening of their heart attack. And chemotherapeutic drugs, a bunch of other stuff like that, like really dangerous stuff that if you just like, take it if you want, you know, we'll put a radioactive isotope in your liver, it's all good. Like that's a goddamn ridiculous.
Yeah, and I think his argument would just be that there's a lot of wonder drugs out there that could save people's lives, but the FDA is blocking them, which, of course, is just so it's just ludicrous. It's not just speculative, but it's also just ludicrous. Like, how the idea that you wouldn't have any type of testing regime is just ridiculous. It's just ridiculous. I mean, you know, but I appreciate the phone call.
Yeah, have a good one.
Bye. Let's go take one more call. Calling from a 314 area code. Who's this?
Hey, this is Andrew.
Hey, Andrew, how's it going?
It's going good. How about you?
Pretty good. What's on your mind?
Yeah, I was just going to say I'm calling from the perspective of an electrical designer that I've done many scrubbers for coal plants. I can tell you there's no such thing as clean coal. I just want to say that if people want to look for proof that global warming is this, all you have to do is just look to our neighboring planet, Venus.
Big runaway greenhouse effect there.
Basically,
was that right?
Basically been engulfed by greenhouse gas.
Wow. Now, you're going to have us believe that there's a planet called Venus. But that's just what scientists say.
Well, I'm not going to go that far, but
government.
I just wanted to get that off my chest because I feel like global warming is one of the biggest issues.
It is the biggest issue, and it's I think in some ways it's so big that it's almost impossible to. I think to a certain extent, like it's very hard. It's so hard to absorb, and there's that. On some level, there's a certain amount of denial that goes into, everything that we do here on some level is because if we were talking about what is going to have the most catastrophic effects across the board, it would be global warming. I mean, even... And everybody, and particularly you see it around the context of like this Larry Lessig thing or Black Lives Matter and other people, I get emails. Why aren't you talking about this? Why aren't you talking about that? At the end of the day, there's probably no there is no political issue that is going to impact everybody more than this. But, it's 50 years out, and to a certain extent, we have a limited amount of ability to impact it. So the frustration level is higher, and I don't mean limited amount of ability, like literally. I mean in terms of like politics. Like it's hard. There's a huge amount of effort that needs to be exerted to move things just slightly.
I've also, I've worked at a nuclear plant. I've worked at several solar plants, as an electrical designer. There's quite a bit of money in solar power as well. I
mean, yep.
There's a lot of billion-dollar companies in renewable energy as well. So.
Well, hopefully it catches up with us. I appreciate
you guys do a great job and always lively with Matthew Film Guy.
Wow.
Thanks, man.
Nice shout out.
Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Oh, yeah.
Mr. Matthew Film Guy's dad. All right, appreciate the call.
Hi, Sam. I'm calling with a libertarian perspective on the solar system. Wonder if you'd be open to debating that.
On the plus side.
The phone connection's really bad, so I can't really hear you.
I'm routing through Voyager 1. On the plus side, though, on Venus, you can cook a pizza in 9 seconds.
Wow.
Just by putting it outside.
Government is the biggest way. How would you get there?
I can't answer every question, Sam.
Well, take an ideal world scenario.
I'm saying we make it here. We
you're
make
just
Venus
there
here.
Because of freedom, and you could have a polling system that said, "Would you like to move to Venus?" And if people said that, then we could. Do you see what I'm saying?
Yeah, the market will.
The market.
Yeah. Oh,
does
you
that.
Know what? That reminds me.
Yeah.
Greg emailed me.
Ooh.
And he wanted me to talk
out.
About the EPA and the spill in Colorado, and I'll get to it probably on Monday.
Is that the Yellow River thing?
Yeah. I mean, basically what happened is this. We have laws in this country that have been on the books for over 100 years that basically say...
Get rid of them.
That basically say you can go into federally owned land and mine and not have to clean it up. It's more or less.
It's in the
and
law.
And so we have in Colorado literally, I think, something like 2,000 former mines with these sludge pools of water and then a series of heavy metals.
Yeah, so what's your
and
point?
And the EPA was there trying to figure out, because there was it was leaching into the Animas River in one of these mines, was leaching in there. And they had heavy machinery in there to try and figure out how they were going to sort of shore up these leaks. And the contractor screwed up. And it is the EPA's, it is a function of the EPA's, I guess you could say, incompetence in this situation. Or there was also certain inevitability. There are some things you can't fix. And the idea, though, that this is comparable to what BP did, which was to take shortcuts and to flout safety regulations in the pursuit of profits versus an underfunded EPA, which is trying to figure out how to prevent a catastrophe that apparently everyone who works in that field out in Colorado knew was inevitable. The idea that these two things are analogous or should be judged in the same manner is beyond
stunning.
Childish. Yeah.
Well, that's essentially like saying that someone who pushed somebody in front of a train is like equally as culpable as the person who tried to save them, not like rescuing the person at the last
right.
minute. You know what I mean?
I mean,
I can think of a better analogy, but like it's ludicrous. The whole point is that they're trying to reverse a disaster, not create one for profit.
Right. Frustrated progressive. I've been annoyed with how people are so ignorant about how important Planned Parenthood is. Abortions only account for 3% of the annual services, and the rest are preventative or screening for STDs, etc. I wish some of these twits knew how mentally and physically straining and dangerous pregnancy is. Well, sadly, men are not going to know that. Savannah, has Matthew seen Black Mirror on Netflix?
No.
I think Matt would like it, too.
I'm looking forward to it, though. It's like a Twilight Zone-ish anthology show. Looks good.
We talked about Mr. Robot?
No, I've only watched the first episode, but I am hooked.
You gotta catch up.
Yeah,
we're gonna check that out.
Really, the best show on TV.
Yeah, I've been enjoying it.
Yes,
I am looking forward to it.
Twos, Sam, film recommendation. Have you seen the Danish TV series Borgen means the castle, made in 2010, 2013, loosely based on recent politics in Denmark? No, obviously a different system from ours. It shows a lot of horse trading, political spinning. And maybe too political for Matt Film Guy. It's available on Netflix. Whoa, shots fired.
This show is too political for me.
Dirty neoliberal. How much influence does the Wall Street Journal opinion page have on society? Not that much anymore, I think. I swear every time a piece of regulation gets gutted, you can almost hear the giggles of the editorial board and the plutocrats, minions who wrote the opinion pieces. Just this morning, an editorial said that a crisis was averted because de Blasio can't regulate banks. There should be a watchdog website that tracks plutocratic Wall Street Journal opinion page. Reagan in the money. In other local news, libertarian state formerly known as Oregon is being swamped by big government bureaucracy. Here's a recent article explaining that Empress Brown has signed 797 bills this year and has no plan to veto the final 43 on her desk. The bureaucratic red tape is flying over here. Jay Tingle. You haven't heard from Maggie Carey for 10 years, then how did she become a film director without references from you? Martin Donovan is definitely not a Marxist in Ant-Man.
Oh, you know, I asked him about that. He said his relationship to capital is that he is just a worker. I buy that.
Jay Tingle, I just had my 9 and 11-year-old nieces, so I can confidently recommend Disney's Descendants as a truly great film. Or so I'm told. So what about the claim from Bush's people that they say down with BLM? There is no planet called Venus. I happen to know that it's Venus is the name of a lady shaver. Scrantix. Obama poll numbers within the margin of error of Bernie's this week in 07. No wonder he lost. He's being sarcastic. Huh. Celinda's Graham. What is right-wing Mandela? What?
I'm not doing anything.
Matt's mic got some sort of weird feedback.
I'm just sitting here. I'm just sitting here.
There we go. What is right-wing Mandela think Rick Perry's failed campaign?
Watching Rick Perry talk is like trying to create a gourmet meal at Robben Island. It's pathetic. Seriously, I mean, I know you're not supposed to laugh at developedly challenged people, but America's too politically correct. Look at that guy.
Majority Report listener, is it possible the DNC establishment superdelegates will become even more of an issue than in 2008 and not allow Bernie to get the nomination? Early to talk about that, but possible.
Oh, I don't usually go this way, but I think if he's actually on the road to the nomination, you will see a legitimate and establishment freakout that will involve a lot of stuff like that.
Yep. Fornia Dye has a great commercial for the Planned Parenthood nonsense. GOP TV talk trash, of course. Cheney and Bush, is Sanders not unlikely anymore? I'm going to take a 1-to-1 odds bet that Bernie will win it all. $50 with a guy at the office. Everybody thinks I'm crazy. I look at the trajectory of poll numbers on a line graph, and I think you're crazy for thinking Bernie is still an underdog. Well, here's the point. You can look at the poll numbers, but I'll tell you what did not happen to Bernie Sanders that happened to Barack Obama. And that is the
Banks.
Leader of the Democratic caucus in the Senate did not walk up to Bernie Sanders and say, hey, you should run.
Mm-hmm. And Bernie's never going to get the backing of big banks that Obama did.
No. Schloop, Vox was an anti-inflammatory drug.
Vioxx.
Deuce Me Daily, speeding up the trial to the market process of life-saving meds is not inconsistent with having FDA oversight. In fact, fully funding the FDA would help speed up the process while also ensuring safety. But when producers are known to be unsafe, thalidomide or that DuPont chemical, hiding this knowledge from the public or persecuting those bringing to light this vital safety information is a serious problem. Toss my salad. How many people are running in the Democratic field, and is Biden really going to run? I don't think Biden's going to run. I don't think Gore's going to run. I think we have seen the total, which is 4.
I'm going to run. You don't know what you're talking about, Sam.
Mighty Max.
That's pretty good.
Someone mentioned yesterday they didn't know how to convince people that Bernie is a better candidate. I would say a good place to start is with comparing the top donor during their careers. If you Google Bernie and Hillary donors meme, you'll find a popular fact sheet that's been circling the web. It compares their top 10 donors throughout their careers. It's been verified by PolitiFact. 7 of 10 Bernie's biggest donors have been unions. 7 of 10 Hillary's have been big corporations or law firms. That's just a starting point. I'll tell you more another day. You're calling on Skype. Who's this?
This is Pam in San Francisco.
Hi, Pam. How are you?
I'm okay. How are you?
I'm doing well.
I have a question. This comes from the discussion from the Republican debate, after the Republican debate. The very last question in the debate was that kind of weird one about, have you gotten word from God about, you know, a specific issue? And in discussing it, Cliff said, some stuff, and then he said, I should have asked a different question. And he said, well, you know, the question they should just ask is, do you believe that on the third day the cave was empty? You know, that Jesus rose again. And I'm curious why you thought that was a particularly good question.
Oh, I think I was being facetious. Because I think the premises embedded in that are ridiculous. In the question that they asked on Fox, just this idea, like, are you talking to God on a rail? I mean, it's just like the idea that it's a yes or no answer. It sort of starts off with the premise of like, are you one of the people blessed to hear God, as opposed to just like, an open-ended question. If you really need to get to that question, make it open-ended. What is your, what guides you in life? What is your spiritual center? Do you have one? To imply that it's so obvious that there's God and asking a question of like, you know, what's your position on this trade deal? Okay. Well, the assumption is that the trade deal is real. It's there. There is a sort of a binary issue. I think just starting with that assumption about God, I found sort of offensive and inappropriate. And so that was my issue.
Okay, thanks. That makes a lot of sense.
Okay,
thank you.
Thanks.
Do you think Khaleesi should gain the Iron Throne?
Right.
I think there's a merit in that argument.
About Khaleesi getting the throne?
Yeah, I think.
Colonize Mars. You would think solar power or wind power would be more popular with businesses since after startup costs and maintenance is basically free money. Yeah, but the people who are in the power business already have the sunk costs into carbon-based stuff. So, you know, it's starting a whole new business from scratch.
Sam, have you ever watched a blind man play cricket?
What?
Rick Perry debating. Zing.
Cat loved Bergen.
Trust me, I'm the best.
I'll check out that
Sammy
Bergen.
Cammer,
that
blaming the EPA for the spills like blaming the firefighters for the WTC, the World Trade Center collapses. They were standing just fine until those government workers went up there. Slow Noman. I hope everyone's seen The House I Live In on Netflix. Super important documentary about the prison industrial complex effect on the black and poor communities. How about this Ben Carson doing research on fetal tissue story? We talked about it yesterday. Jay Tingle. Borgen is very political, but it's Danish. And my question was about Jeb meeting with BLM. Do you suppose such a meeting actually occurred?
No, they interrupted him.
And I think they did. I mean, I'm not sure that there wasn't a meeting. I'm not sure about that.
All lives matter.
FCP. Love the members only part because of the hilarious takedowns of juvenile libertarians. Emailed you about the New York Times magazine about Liberland. You catch that piece when it came out. Also, go Bernie. Love to ask the libertarians when they tell me regulation stops innovation in business. What do you think spurs innovation, if not regulation, to which industry must respond? Indeed.
The greater Nurse, the limits, the greater the art.
Indeed. Nurse Stanley, yeah, Vioxx was an anti-inflammatory drug. What do you think a heart attack is but damaged inflamed heart tissue? Honestly, libertarians need to stop Wikipediaing issues as if statements of facts equals context in an argument. Blockistan, don't know if my last text about the song email came through. The app seemed to glitch out for a second. It didn't. And I did not get... Oh, the song was too long. You got to email us with a shorter version. 1 minute. Don 88, Sam, MM, Matthew, film guy. What's up, bros? The right has a fantasy that Chris Christie missed his opportunity in 2012. Given the current political climate, Senator Elizabeth Warren would be our next president if she had chosen to run. What do you think? I don't know. It's a tough call. All right, the final IM of the day. FYI, the gold mine had the potential to be an EPA Superfund site, but they gave up on the plan due to lack of community support. Durango and the surroundings are generally very conservative. Had the access to the Superfund monies, the spill might have been prevented. Ladies and gentlemen, have a great weekend. Matthew, film guy.
Thanks, Sam.
Thank you so much. What can we plug of yours?
I cut down a student film of mine into a vine. I've decided that I'm going to change all of my short films into 6-second little films to compete in the Vine space. And they actually look pretty interesting that way. So you can visit me on Twitter at Langdon Boom, and you'll find it there.
See you guys on Monday. Matt and Michael be here. I'll be back on Tuesday.
Bye. It might take all the strength I got to get to where I want, but I know somehow I'm gonna get there. I wasn't looking when I just got caught between the truth and the light bulb. Finding out won't make me feel any better. Yeah, I know the clock is ticking, but the meds are gonna kick in, and my pilot light shining bright. I guess somewhere the choice is made for the option where you don't get paid for the road that bends before it finally breaks you. I guess somehow I lost my drive between the 101.